Welcome to Law Subscribed. This is your dedicated news source for all things subscriptions and the law. My name is Matthew Kurbis. I'm the subscription attorney, and I believe subscriptions can help bridge the access to justice gap and incentivize attorneys to modernize and scale their practice like never before. In this episode, I interview Jonathan Moranek. Jonathan is general counsel for GCM Partners, an industry leader in telehealth psychedelic treatment. GCM Partners affiliates with Revitalist Clinic, a pioneer in ketamine infusion therapy. He joined me on the podcast to talk about health and well-being. Jonathan is passionate about the subject, and we dive deep on why the billable hour is just bad for your health and how your work quality suffers if you're not in good health. Thank you to my sponsors, 650 and Gavel. Links to both in the show notes. More on them later. Remember to use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED when signing up. It lets them know you found out about them from the podcast. You get 10% off, and it supports the show. I'd love to hear about your experience using my sponsors. Keep those messages coming in. You could send me a direct message on LinkedIn or email me your comments at kurbis@lawsubscribe.com. For subscriptionseminar.com, I'm taking firms off the waitlist one at a time in the order they signed up, so sign up to get your spot in line. I'm an active participant in that process of helping you use the subscription model, and I'm a full-time practicing attorney, so I can only help so many at a time. Thank you for your patience. Another way to support the show is share with someone you know. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and nothing said is legal, ethical, or financial advice. Without further delay, here's the episode. Jonathan Moranek, thank you so much for coming on the Law Subscribed podcast.
Happy to be here.
Well, we've had a chance to talk, but and also discovered that we used to go to Chicago Bar Association networking events some years ago. But for my audience who doesn't know you yet, go ahead and give yourself an introduction.
Sure. I've been a licensed attorney since 2007. I practiced for a few firms, Fuchs & Corsheid. I was their first associate ever. Then at Ferrand Glennon, where I got into construction law. When I was hired, it was, do you know how to read blueprints? I said, no. And they said, well, you're going to learn. And I represented architects and engineers in malpractice suits. And then I worked at Ogletree Deacons and represented primarily contractors and developers in construction defect, design defects, delay. From there, when the pandemic hit, I went in-house to a company called GCM Partners, which is a management services organization, to a telehealth clinic that practices psychedelic medicine, ketamine-assisted therapy for patients with treatment-resistant mental health disorders, PTSD, anxiety, chronic pain. That practice morphed from a medical cannabis practice, which my partners started in 2017. We also have a medical grade CBD line that we developed along the way with a partner in Utah. And here we are today.
Cutting edge, man, we're the company that you're working for. I mean, I'm reading things in the news or hearing podcasts about some of the loosening of regulations, allowing for more and more of that. So seems to be trending in the right direction and hopefully helps a lot of people.
Yeah, the first line treatment, it mostly still is and has been for a long time pharmaceutical intervention. So you're thinking of Prozac, Cymbalta, Ativan, Xanax. And those are drugs that are supposed to be short interventions, but people end up being on them for years. So we get patients and almost all of them are on one of those types of drugs, SSRI, SNRI, benzodiazepine. And we ask people to give us 6 to 9 months and we attempt to get them off all their medications so they're living a balanced, healthy life.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Don't want to hide the ball too much longer from the listeners thinking, you know, what is this GC doing here? But I think that the health is really important. And I suppose like law school doesn't teach you how to practice law, let alone about blueprints. If you're going to be in that line of work as an attorney, you had to learn it. So, you know, did you have to learn about health for your current role? Or was that already something that you had gotten into even before you became a GC?
My business partners are doctors. And so there was an overlap there. But I had credibility. My undergrad education, I was a major in kinesiology. So I've always been interested in it. I thought that I would go to medical school. It was too daunting at the time. As a 20-year-old, you make decisions in a different way than you do now. So it wasn't for me then. In retrospect, it could have been, but I became an attorney. But I've always had an interest in health. I was an athlete growing up and I've always been interested in sports. And now I've been to yoga and meditation. It's just become something that's part of my everyday life.
Yeah, I was always into sports too. And I leaned into cycling in college because that was like easy to do. And I went to IU where cycling is huge. But when you're not competing as an athlete, I then got into like Tai Chi and stuff too. Mm. You know, still, it's still good to be athletic in a way, but you know, it takes on a whole new meaning when you're not trying to either, you know, get a scholarship to college or you want to go pro or something like that. Did you ever want to like go pro or do something, play in college?
Oh, of course. When I was 8, I thought I was going to be in the NHL, like a lot of kids. And it's hockey is all I wanted to do. And then the stark realization when high school tryouts came around that not only was I not on the first line, I didn't even make the team. So you have to adjust expectations.
Is there... like, what is like the weirdest sport that you've played or most unusual sport that you've done?
What I do primarily now for the past 6+ years is Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And mm-hmm. from a commonality perspective, very unusual. Not a lot of people know what it is, let alone have they ever tried it.
I suppose if you're into MMA, you might have heard of it.
Correct. Yeah.
But
yeah, MMA for our listeners is essentially grappling plus striking, and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is the grappling half of that equation.
Yeah, mixed martial arts, right? And so, even fans of that have heard of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but to have done it or be practicing it is a whole different story. For me, it's trapeze, but that's another story for another time.
Yeah, wow.
So I heard you on the Chicago Bar podcast at the bar, which I'm always happy to promote Legal Talk Network shows on here. I've had some hosts of some of their shows on the podcast, but you were brought on there to talk about the four main categories of hell. And so how about you tell my audience what that is, and we'll get back to the billable hour, I promise. I promise you listeners.
Sure. While there is quite a bit of overlap between all these categories, and it's infinitely more complex than we're making it, it's easy to think about health in four categories: sleep, exercise, diet, mental health management.
And well, I mean, us, you know, lawyers, we love to categorize things and put things in lists with, you know, subheadings and all that. But let's just, I mean, in like at a high level, you know, what do each of these things, like, what's the value of each one of these?
At the end of the day, lawyers, like all professionals, we need to perform. And from a science-based approach, your performance is optimal if you are optimizing all four aspects of health. If you are poorly slept, you won't perform well. If you are malnourished, you won't perform well. It's the equation's pretty simple. It's like a table with four legs, and if one of them is rickety or shorter, it's going to affect the entire equation.
And a reminder for the listeners that, Jonathan, you're not selling anything when it comes to these health things. You're just a general, you're your general counsel at a company, and this is just something that you're passionate about, right?
That's right. Our aim is to get people to be healthy, and life is the most rewarding and enjoyable, and you can perform your best when you're healthy. There's no money to be made here. The only person coming out on top is the fruit and vegetable farmer when people are healthy.
Right. Now, I did have a performance coach on episode 11, and he talked about conscious flow control, which is actually, Jonathan, maybe an episode that you'd be interested in listening to in light of your interest in health. So it might make a good complimentary episode to this. But one of the themes that came through your other interview that I listened to and I thought was really well done by Jonathan and Trish was that the billable hour makes it really hard to have four legs of this health table remain really strong, and that there's an opportunity cost with having to build time and be able to focus on these things. And so what's your perspective on that?
Your health is completely part of your personal life as far as the law firm machine is confirmed. It's bill the hours, hit the quotas, however you manage the four legs of the table outside, I'm not interested. Just be at the office, get the work done, go home and do what you're going to do there. And that for lawyers, there's an expectation of essentially perfection. So we want our lawyers to be perfect and work many hours a day and have little oversight. And we don't want to train anybody. And right. So we want all these things, but that's a really tall order if your lawyers aren't healthy.
So even at these traditional law firms where you're billing time, this is an important message for the firm owners or for the partners is that if you want more productivity out of your associates or yourself as a part business owner, like these things matter. And I'm sure the places, the last firms that you worked at were perfectly great places to work. I've certainly heard of Ogletree Deacons and I've heard great things. But this applies to the profession at large, you know, these, what you just talked about hitting, getting your quotas, billing your time, sacrificing personal things in order to get there. And the opportunity cost is you can make a boatload of money at a partner at a medium or large sized firm. But what's the quality of life that you're going to live as a result of that, both personally and health-wise? But I really like your take on that. It also goes back to the firm where the lawyer can do better work and get better outcomes if they themselves are healthy. So assuming you're at one of these billable hour firms, how do you pick which one of these four categories you're supposed to focus on? Diet, exercise, mental health, and sleep?
Yeah, it's one of my old bosses used to describe the practice of law as keeping all the marbles on the table. And sometimes some of them fall off, but it's a never-ending game. There's no plateau. If you are in a billable hour environment, it's a constant juggling exercise. But there are some baseline conditions that we know through research that can't really be negotiated with. You need at least 7 hours of sleep per night in order to maintain an objectively healthy body and mind. You have to eat a minimum amount of nutrients, and or you will not progress in your physical and mental development. If you don't manage your stress, you will burn out. It's without question. And there is an interest, or should be, I should say, by law firms who have a billable hour model to make sure that their attorneys don't burn out or make mistakes. Because the mental health toll is much easier to deal with when you catch it at the beginning. We tend to think of mental health as somebody flamed out, made a big mistake. They had a panic attack. But that's a long slide into those conditions. So if law firms were better at managing these things in real time, they would have less worry about the long-term effects of failing to maintain health.
I'm actually really glad you explained it that way because it makes me think of the sales pitch for the subscription model for legal services, which is to clients, from lawyers to clients, which is something that I get asked about all the time. Well, how do you even sell that? And I also have my law firm subscription attorney LLC, that's what I'm selling. And you're selling problem avoidance, right? So the sales pitch there is essentially don't wait until your legal problem is so bad that you have no choice but to hire an attorney. Because but that is also where most attorneys are marketing to. It's like solving the problem after it's bad. Now I could charge a premium. And that's why clients continue to pay the billable hours. Oftentimes it's because that problem maybe could have been avoided, but wasn't. But lawyers aren't there to meet that problem at a reasonable price point. They're there to be the plumber who fixes the burst legal pipe, not the plumber who comes and fixes the leaky pipe. And so it's the same thing with health, is what you're saying, is it's don't wait till your health problem is so bad that you have to go seek out a health coach and take time off work and do all these other things. It's like this is just like as subscription attorneys, we are trying to sell our legal services prophylactically. You have to take care of your health that way too if you want to be the best attorney or anything that you human that you could be. Is that a good analogy?
It's a perfect one. I mentioned this line in the CBA show and they ended up using it as part of their promotion of it. But if you fail to make time for your health now, you'll be forced to make time for your health problems later. And if you manage it well, you won't get a burst pipe. And there are some very straightforward strategies to do this. And we can talk about those if you want, but when you cross the street, you have to look both ways. There are just some non-negotiables in life. And it would behoove law firms to accept these realities. And it would be better for all of them. If we could snap our fingers and they could all adjust overnight, everything would be better for everyone. But there's a persuasion game in trying to convince law firms that their lawyers should work less because it's better for them in the long run.
I'd like to go over some of the methodologies on how to do these things, but I also think it's important to talk about why the billable hour doesn't lend itself to them sort of in tandem. And I think that this can be like a great thing for if you're an associate listening to this podcast and you're working at a firm that's billing time and you're trying to innovate within the practice, that this is just another, this becomes another reason why, and it's not just about being able to scale your business, which is a huge value to the subscription model. It incentivizes automations, adoption of technology and efficiencies so that you could take on more clients and now you're not billing your time. But this is a really important element, is the health side of things. And if you're only making money when you're billing time, then you're incentivized to just bill as much time as possible and not focus on your health. And so let's talk about the methodologies. And at least if you're an attorney listening and you're at a billable hour firm, also, Jonathan, for them, like, which ones are the most important ones? Or if they're like, well, I can't get sleep because I have to bill time, so I'm just going to focus on what I eat. Like, is that the right thing to do? So like, what's the right approach to take if you're somebody still in that billable hour environment?
Well, if you're looking at it from a long range time factor, they're all important. No one is more important than the other. But if you're looking at it from a short range time factor, say 48 hours, if you are sleep deprived over 48 hours, your performance is going to plummet much worse than it would if you had a deficiency in any of the other three categories. If you can survive for 7 days without food, it wouldn't be pleasant, but you can more or less get your life done depending on how much body fat you have.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If you're stressed out, some people perform well under stress in a short period of time. There's no one that will do it well over a long period of time. And people go months without working out and they can generally be functional. But try working 24, 48, 72 hours in a row with 4 hours of sleep per night. Just the amount of impediment that the body faces from poor sleep is, we don't need to explain to anybody what it feels like to not be well slept, but from a science standpoint, if you're poorly slept for one night, 4 or 5 hours of sleep, your brain will show buildup of amyloid and tau protein. And these are the same proteins found in the brains of Alzheimer's patients. Something happens during the sleep cycle that allows the brain to exhaust those proteins and have it perform optimally.
If that's not a reason that all of you listening right now should just go take a nap or get those, but it's not just about a nap, right? It's about those 7 hours of continuous sleep. And I'm sure there's some variability for genetics and stuff, but I mean, on average, like I try to get 8 hours of sleep a night. That was always something for me that was a non-negotiable, even when I was billing my time, is I had to get 8 hours of sleep a night. And then I became a dad. And suddenly that was very negotiable with my child. So I think context matters a little bit. I still try to get as much sleep as I can, but with even nothing work-related, but with like a small child who will come into your room in the middle of the night and disturb your sleep, that's maybe a forgivable sort of situation. But if you're staying up all night because you haven't hit your hourly quota and you need to hit your hourly quota, your work's going to be in poor performance and you're going to be build up whatever the Alzheimer chemical is in your brain. So that's not good. I'd always put health before billable time and deal with the other issues later, but we know that lawyers aren't doing that, right? So then after sleep, which sounds like the absolutely most important thing you should be getting, reasonably in like a lawyer's routine, like what's sort of the next most reasonable thing that a lawyer should be able to focus on?
I think next is exercise. So there are ways to manage your stress without exercise, but a great incidental benefit of exercise is it has a prominent effect on your mental health mm-hmm. in a positive way. Anybody knows that's done a hard workout, they've gone for a long run or whatever, climbed a mountain, done a hike, how great you feel afterwards. And if you're really into it during, you find yourself in this flow state, meditative or mindful state where you weren't thinking about work, and the processes that your body goes through when it's under strenuous exercise exhaust all of these chemicals that play into the stress response from our bodies. I talked a bit about on the CBA podcast about the fight or flight response. Mm-hmm. When we are stressed, the body provides neurochemicals, mostly cortisol and adrenaline, in order for us to fight or run. We've conditioned ourselves in modern society to respond that way to non-violent scenarios like deadlines if you don't exercise, you don't burn off those chemicals and you just swim in them constantly, and they have a debilitating effect short term and long term.
And for what it's worth, like each one of these categories could be like a series of episodes of our own podcast, right? Like
there are people that have dedicated their careers to studying parts of just one of these categories.
Right. I mean, there are apps for everything. There's tracking your sleep apps. There's exercise apps. I mean, a lot of these come default now on smartphones and smartwatches. There's mental health apps, even like the mindfulness apps I'm thinking, where it's just like, take a 5-minute break and like just breathe for 5 minutes. And then it lets you know, you don't have to think about it because it will let you know when those 5 minutes are up, which is part of like the clearing your mind thing, or just focusing on one thought thing, depending on which, mental health philosophy you're using. And there are there've been diet apps, forever, but I think they're getting better. I think they're getting a little bit better than they used to be. So there are apps for all of these things. But for like the exercise, the mental health, and the sleep, if you're a billable hour attorney, and let's say your billable hour is $500 an hour, right? You're sleeping for 7 hours a night, like Jonathan recommended. Let's say you're giving yourself 1 hour of exercise time and, 5 minutes, which will round up to 1/10 of an hour, right? For mental health a day. So every day, then you're looking at 8.1 hours, so $500 an hour. So all of that's costing you, if you're a billable hour attorney, $4,050, right? Yeah, if you're billing your time, if that's right, how you're thinking about it.
Yeah, the opportunity cost to be healthy is expensive when you're on that construct.
Right, right. But then if you decouple your time from the value that you're giving your clients, and they're paying you for the value or for the outcome, even if that outcome is no bad thing happened or we avoided bad things from happening, then you could stop thinking about that and you could put more time into it. I had Steve Fretzen on the podcast and we were talking about business development. And he's Chicago area. I don't know if you ever heard of Fretzen, but one of the things, he wants attorneys to commit to is to do business development. I mean, that's what he helps lawyers build their book of business. But when you're billing your time, it's hard, it's costing you money to build your book, and you have to then rationalize, well, what's the potential revenue you could bring in from the business development? But one of the outcomes that we talked about there was when you're no longer billing your time and you're making money without having to actually be simultaneously working on the thing, then you're able to spend more time doing business development. And now I feel kind of bad because I feel like you should also be dedicating some of that time to your health and do these things that we talked about. I mean, sleep is non-negotiable, it sounds like, but I could be better with exercise and diet, I know, right now. So like, I'm going to commit myself to some of that. And I do time blocking. I mean, have you come across this time blocking concept yet, or putting in blocks on your calendar?
Scheduling certainly helps. I mean, I tend to live and die by my calendar now. I think a lot of people do because they're electronic, and there's too much going on to try to keep it all in your head. So yes, scheduling time helps. A simple solution is attending exercise classes. You have somebody yell at you. There are other people around watching. So if you're out exercising by yourself and you just go for a jog, it's really easy to say, hey, you know what? Having a rough day. I'm going to walk a little bit or go slow or whatever it is. And when you have the pressure of others around you, it tends to make that exercise more efficient.
Accountability partners, right?
Mm-hmm. And certainly.
Small business owners listening, especially solopreneurs like me, we know that having an accountability partner for your business is really important, because you could time block that thing on your calendar to work on that client project. But if no one else works for you and you're the only person, you have no accountability partner, it's just as easy to not work on that and, watch another episode of The Mandalorian or whatever, right? So the analogies are mounting, Jonathan, for the just being like a small business owner and not committing yourself to something or having an accountability partner. So gosh, there's got to be like an app or something that's like, right, find your exercise accountability partner, right? Even if you're in different states or something, you go running at the same time during the day or something like that, right?
Maybe there's a chat bot being developed to yell at you if you're not being as efficient as you should be. But
when I went solo, I pivoted from mostly litigation to a transactional only practice. I did not have a database of documents to automate. That's why a business and employment legal document database and automation tool like 650 is super useful. I can rely on the quality of the documents in 650's database since they're putting excellent legal minds to work curating and updating their documents and automations over time. When you're not billing by the hour, outsourcing and efficiency matters, and 650 can help you scale your practice to get high-quality documents drafted in less time. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at 650.com and when being onboarded to get 10% off. If you're not a business and employment attorney, or you have your own documents that you'd prefer to use, then my next sponsor, Gavel, is the automation tool for you. Gavel allows you to build shareable, client-facing workflow and document automations. In other words, Gavel helps you create a legal practice where attorneys can monetize the value they bring clients in productized form at scale via subscriptions and flat fees. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at gavel.io to get 10% off an annual subscription. There's no one right way to automate and scale your practice, but with one or both of my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, you can take your subscription law firm to the next level. Links to both in the show notes. Now back to the show.
The thing that I found the most, that plagued my mind the most when I was billing time at all the law firms, was how all the time goes into two buckets, billable and non-billable. Mm-hmm. And the pressure to meet the hourly quotas was so high that it removed the incentive to be efficient. If you had a motion to dismiss to write, and that should take, and I emphasize the word should, 2.5 hours, depending on what the other your associates would do or what you'd see in the industry or what your boss would or would not get mad about. If you could finish that motion in an hour because you've done it before and you're good and you know the law and you don't need to review the cases, you can't bill 2.5 hours for that 1 hour of work. But on a non-billable model, if you could finish the motion in an hour and then hit the gym or then go and get a nap or spend time with your kid or your wife or husband or whatever, that improves the quality of your life.
So
I think I'm preaching to the choir here to you, but that's...
Yes. I mean, I said, I think this type of conversation can be ammunition for other attorneys who are in this situation and they're trying to create change in their organization. So, you know, you brought it up. So you used to bill time and now you don't, I'm assuming. You don't track your time as a GC. Is that right?
Correct.
What has that done for your ability to focus on your health?
Well, part and parcel to what I just said, I have discrete tasks and I have some generalized tasks. I mean, I'm the guardian of the organization, so I'm always trying to identify threats and assess risks. Sometimes I have to negotiate a contract, review a document, read some pertinent news article, but it's not tied to billing my time. So the more efficiently I can do that, the better I can make my schedule to attend to my health needs. Or if I want to meet a friend or a potential business partner or something in the middle of the day, I can do that without having to worry about who's looking over my shoulder and whether this time is being allocated onto the timesheet.
And then even if you end up working more hours than you were as a billable cog in the machine, not having to track your time certainly helps your mental health, I would think. So, I do think that because I used to be that. Yeah, that was my experience. I used to bill time. Now I don't. Was that your experience as well?
Oh, yeah. And the last time I checked, the time it took you to track your time was not billable. Right. So, I got pretty good at when I first got to Ogletree, many lawyers used hard copy timesheets. And I would see some of the partners because we shared secretaries among two or three lawyers. And I would see some of these timesheets. And they were handwritten. And then there was additional time for the secretaries to put time into the computer. I always did it electronically. And I developed a pretty good habit of putting the time entry in as soon as I got done with the task. Because the couple of times that I didn't, it would be Friday at 4 p.m. and I'd be in the office for an hour and a half entering my time and trying to recreate all the entries that I forgot. And there were some stories of partners where, you know, oh, he or she is doing their time and it's like after lunch on a Friday and none of it had been entered all week. There's no lawyer that can recall every distinct time entry over the past 5 days of 8 or 9 or 10 hour days, and they're capturing it all. Impossible.
Especially if they're not getting sleep, because then their brain can't remember all those things.
That's right.
Right.
And then there are ethical issues around. Was it a point one or a point two? Or like it's problematic all around. And yeah. I think there are certainly situations where the billable hour needs to be present, right? You know a lot more about that than I do, but much of the practice of law could be on a non-billable format.
So I think that certainly right now, given the current status quo, I mean, there are some situations where you do not know how long something is going to take. And even when you're not billing your time, the goal is the faster, the better, as long as in our profession, it's ethical, it's effective, not just efficient, right? But I do think that some lawyers can, depending on their industry, come up with a number that they would be happy with on a flat fee and or subscription basis, that regardless of how long it took, they would be happy with that number. And I think that that's where like litigation stuff comes in for the subscription plus flat fee. And I am curious to get your perspective on this as an in-house counsel who has to hire, I'm sure, outside counsel and is probably, the company's probably paying them on the billable hour, especially for litigation matters. But the idea is, if they're collecting their data in a way that's easy to understand, I don't know that all law firms do that, but especially their bigger firms do, you could see how much a case is going to make you on average, even if it's a litigation matter. And you could see, well, some cases do end up, they make us more money because they take more time. Some take less time and we make less money, but I'm sure you could find an average. And if then you could break that down in a, well, we want to get to that same number, but we're going to do X amount to start flat fee, Y amount monthly throughout the duration of the case, and then a success fee based on, you know, three possible results, right? You either settle or you go to trial, right? Or maybe
Or a motion to dismiss before discovery, right.
You could have milestones of success fees if you're successful on any of these things, right? Flat fee. So like, and you make it high enough and a multiple of the Y amount that's monthly that you're incentivized to get there and not just drag the case out because the monthly subscription amount is not going to be sufficient that you're incentivized as a lawyer to drag it out. I do have a formula like I'm building to try to solve this problem, but that's the gist of it. And so Even that, and that's the biggest hurdle that I've come across is people are litigation. You just don't know how long things are going to take. What's your initial thoughts on hearing that as a solution to that problem?
When I was trying cases, I would have said that the billable hour is the only way to track this. When you do have data, litigation is more or less predictable. Some cases there'd be two depositions. Some there are 10. And that oral discovery is probably the hardest one to handicap, the hardest stage of the case to handicap. But I think you're right that there is a number that the lawyer would be happy with and that the client would be happy with, and neither is going to take advantage of one or the other in that process.
And even if the client ends up spending on average the same amount of money, they can budget for it because they know what it's going to be. If this is a one-year case or a five-year case, I know as the client what my legal spend is going to be. And just as a business to operate and know what that spend is instead of like knowing what it is until it's over, like that has value to it. And yet they're still spending the same amount of money and the law firm is still making the same amount of money. And you don't have to track your time, which gives you the ability to focus on your health or business development or whatever, your family, all these other things, right?
That's right. Well, and I could imagine a response from a billable hour lawyer saying that, well, if we have a flat fee and we have a heavy month, I'm doing 8 deps in 4 weeks. And so there's all this prep time and everything else. But the following month, you might bill 2 hours to the file, right? And if you are on a flat fee model, while you have a heavy month, you're incentivized to work more quickly.
Right. And then you have more time to do other things. And you've made the same amount of money if you're on the subscription plus flat fee type setup with litigation. And, you know, I know subscription attorneys who will, when something goes outside the scope of the subscription package, like they will bill hours because they just haven't been able to come up with that number yet. What's that number for that type of thing? And so I think as we have more attorneys using alternative fees, and I even interviewed a Canadian company called AltFee, which they're trying to help lawyers come up with these, like what their prices should be. We're going to see more and more solutions. And eventually, I think eventually, to respond to your initial point of there are some situations where the billable hour still works, there's still the better option. I think that right now that's true. But as we have more attorneys adopting alternative fees and learning different ways and better ways to do it, I think that eventually that won't be true. And certainly with generative AI, tasks that used to take 10 hours can take 10 minutes or 1 hour. So does it make sense to 10x your billable rate? Even if you, even if your client spends the same amount of money and you make the same amount of money, I feel like paying $10,000 an hour or $5,000 an hour, your client isn't going to want to see that on the bill. What do you think?
Of course not. I still take referral matters here and there on the side. I'm fortunate my partners allow me to moonlight a bit, and it keeps me engaged in the litigation process, and you know, a little bit of walking around money. And I've always liked litigating. But so I tend to represent condominium owners, small businesses, stuff, scaled down matters from what I used to do, which was industrial and commercial clients. Mm-hmm. Every single one of them asks about costs, but the general public, your general small business owner, has no sense of what a contract should cost, meaning drafting, negotiation, finalize the discussion with the client about the business. LegalZoom, I think, has perverted people's sense of what things should cost versus what the quality that they're getting is. And it's like, well, I can go on LegalZoom and I can get a contract for $100. And I've said, great, go for it. But as more data comes out and clients have a better sense of what tasks or items should cost, then I think the subscription model is going to catch fire. Right. But having to explain costs to every client, they simply don't know. It's like going into the restaurant and not being aware of what the price of the menu items are. But if you get the bill and the steak was $300, you could say to yourself, I've never had a $300 steak. Well, here they're $300. That's what kind of an explanation is that?
Right. I mean, price opacity, right? Like that is a problem. And in my CLE, that's one of the things that I talk about. It's like, you know, legal services are like going to a restaurant, ordering the fish at market price, and you say to the server, what's the market price? And, you know, in reality, they could tell you. But what if they told you, well, first we have to calculate the time it took, you know, for the fish to hatch in its egg, to grow to maturity, to be caught by the fisherman and prepared by the chef. And like, I do a longer version for the CLE. And then how long does it take for the server to bring it to your plate? Then you eat the fish. And whether you liked it or not, here's your bill. Pay up or we'll see you in court to collect.
Correct.
And in the legal profession, to continue the metaphor, you know, the legal profession is like the restaurant here. And like restaurants are like law firms. And all restaurants, they charge the same, right? And they have a monopoly on fish. And so only restaurants can provide you with fish. If you go anywhere else, you know, you know, they're committing unlicensed practice of restaurants, right? Of fish or whatever. So it's complicated, right? Like it behooves the lawyer in this situation. We have the monopoly on legal services, right? And if we don't, Arizona and Utah will become the rest of the country. And I say that because they're re-regulating legal services where now non-lawyers can own law firms. And there might be some benefit to that. I don't know. We'll see. That's what's great about living in the, you know, democracy that we have, where states are the laboratories. But
are they
permitting
non-lawyers to perform legal services or simply have ownership in a corporate way?
A little bit of both, but it's very, to the extent that they're allowing like paralegal professionals, it is very limited scope, and there's still licensing and all these other things, but it's much less expensive to get that licensing than by going to law school, having to pass the bar exam. So by reducing the cost of getting the license for certain limited legal activities,
I see.
You can, I mean, economically, you should be able to offer those for a lower cost, even if it's a lower billable hour rate where it's like $100 an hour instead of $500. But primarily, the most interesting aspect is the non-lawyer ownership of the law firm and what that also allows in terms of innovation, but also potential influence from non-lawyers having ownership of the law firm. So there's pros and cons. I lean more towards, I'm very interested in the pros, but as an attorney, I'm thinking about all the ethical considerations. So it behooves us as a profession to abandon the billable hour so that the monopoly is not taken away. Because right now, so many people, the latent legal market, are not getting access to legal services because you won't call your lawyer at $300 an hour to try to solve a legal leaky pipe, because it doesn't make any sense to do that.
That's right. Yeah, this reminds me of a couple of things. The Rainmaker, Danny DeVito's character, perennially fails the bar, and he calls himself paralawyer because in our business now we have what's called the corporate practice of medicine, and many states don't allow non-physicians to own medical clinics. And there is also a price opacity in medicine too. You want to go in and you have a laceration, and it's, I need this stitched up. It's going to be 7 stitches. How much is it? Well, the physician's going to have to tell you. You ask the doctor, I don't know, that our billing department handles it. And you won't find out what that suture treatment costs until you get the bill. And that's pretty wild. In Japan, there is a manual, and every single medical treatment is described, and there's a fixed price on it. And it's, if you have a 4-inch cut that requires 7 stitches, that's $95 to treat, or for example, right? And that's something that I'm sure the general public in the United States would love to see.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it does make me think of my model, right? Which my model at a base level, I have to explain this so much. It's not clear from my website that this is like essentially what it boils down to. But for most people who end up signing up, like this is what I explain. And then they're like, yes, I want that. I'll sign up. $20 a month, $50 a paid. And so it gets close to LegalZoom. But the reality is that I've unbundled all my legal services, right? So if they want me to negotiate that contract for them, that's another $200 a month, right? And so like it can get more expensive, but you're still going to know exactly how much it's going to cost based on how many months that something's going to take. And I'm incentivized to automate my contracts that I'm giving clients, just like LegalZoom has it automated, right? So it's not cost. Once the contract is built, and if the automation is built, I give my client a link that they fill out through one of my sponsors of the podcast, which I use. I won't just let anyone sponsor the podcast. I have to use the technology and make sure it's good. But it's Gabble, and like Gabble used to be Documate, and so I could send a client-facing like form for them to fill out, and then we go over it together. So like the legal work is like going over the contract with them to make sure it's, because I built the automations to make sure it's customized to the client's needs to a certain extent, and then we could do some finer tuning customization. And so $50 a page actually ends up being a lot of money when you don't have to do that much work.
Well, sure. And the stuff about which you're uncertain, some of those assignments are going to take you longer than others. But over time, there is a number that you could probably point to where at some point you'll know that I'm going to charge the client $200 a month for the negotiation. It's probably going to take me 1.2 hours, right? And
I mean, I've stopped even thinking about that though, Jonathan, believe it or not, because that helps to get started, right? Like it definitely helps to get started. But when you're not even thinking about time equals money anymore, you're just incentivized to build more automations, build more of a funnel to get clients in and get output so the clients are getting what they want. And so I've even just completely stopped thinking about that. It is a useful tool if you're just getting started, for sure. But like the example I give is for my estate plans. And as we start to round up the interview here, we'll get your input and your feedback on this is, my simple estate plans are a product where they actually get a lawyer to consult with them on just a living will, a last will and testament, powers of attorney for healthcare and property. Now, these are all things that you could probably find for free online or very low cost. I charge $400 to my subscribers, even starting at $20 a month. And I spend maybe 30 minutes to an hour actually doing anything with my clients when they sign up for that because I've automated so much of the estate plan already. Now, if their situation is such that a simple estate plan is not what they need, that's not the right product for them. And they either need to pay for a more expensive estate plan, which I do offer, or they could go to an attorney that will charge them by the hour or something to do a highly customized estate plan for them, or some lawyers charge very high flat fees for that. But for the clients where it's the right product, and they sign up and they get that service, I'm spending less than an hour, somewhere between 30 minutes to an hour. So if you wanted to think about it, it's like $400 an hour per estate plan. But since they're a subscriber, and I'm not just thinking about one-off transactions, I'm thinking about what's the next transaction that I'm going to help them with. Because even though they're paying only $20 a month, I'm their lawyer. And when people come to you for legal advice, they're not just trying to milk you for all the legal advice. When it's usually around, here's a document, right? Or here's a potential dispute that I need negotiated. Like there's always something more. So it's almost like they're paying me to market to me, for me to market to them.
Right.
So they come to me. And so I'm willing to take a even though I'm arguably making $400 an hour on those transactions, I'm even willing to take a loss because they're going to keep coming to me for other things. So what do you think about that model?
Well, I'm a fan of it. I want to point out something you said when I asked you. You said, I've stopped thinking about it. Your models permitted you to realize a mental health benefit. Mm-hmm. You no longer burden your mind with the process of trying to assess whether this case or this project will be worth it because you figured out a better way to do it. There's a dirty little thing in the law. It's kind of like talking about Fight Club. You're not supposed to talk about it. Every lawyer is supposed to be passionately in love with the practice of law. Like, that's what we say publicly. That's what we say at cocktail parties and networking events. And that's what we tell the clients. But just saying the word relativity probably puts shivers in the spines of many associates. Or if you have 10 cases that you have to actually read because they're in the opposing counsel's brief, you can't just control F your way through it. Very few lawyers want to read 10 cases in a day and figure out how the other side is misusing them. If there was a quicker, more efficient way to get that work done and then get to the pool or get to the golf course, why shouldn't lawyers want to do that? All other professions are totally fine with, yeah, we got the project done, we closed it, and we did 9 before dinner time. If you heard your lawyer say that, you'd be like, you know, why am I paying $400 an hour for this guy?
Yeah.
I'm a big fan. I'm doing it. Now, in-house jobs aren't all that common, right? And the very reason that they're enjoyable is because you don't have to bill your time, and it's a different model, and you're really onto something here. And I hope more attorneys adopt it.
And I think that the lessons that you're trying to impart to the listeners today on the importance of health comport well with stopping, with no longer billing your time. And I think it opens up the opportunities to consider your sleep, your mental health, your being able to exercise and diet. I mean, there are a million resources on how to do all these things. And when you're no longer billing your time, you're able to focus on them. Any last words of wisdom on those health topics for the listeners before we say goodbye?
Yeah, something that comes up a lot is, and it's a real issue, we've talked about it here today, is I don't have enough time. I would encourage each person listening to really spend 30 minutes, sit down and assess what your day looks like. You can find 20 or 30 minutes during the day to do some high intensity exercise, sit and meditate, cook something healthy. There is time there, but it's trade-offs. You know, how many shows are you watching? How many times are you looking at the phone? There are ways to figure it out. It just takes a little bit of focus.
And I think it's absolutely necessary to dedicate time to that because the subscription model is not a magic bullet. It's not going to one-shot solve all your problems. You could have the model set out. You could have the technology powering the law firm. And like we've talked about before, you could have all that and you could be the best lawyer ever. But if you can't get clients, then none of that matters. Well, I think the same thing is true of health. Even if you're just focusing on everything else, you're not taking care of yourself and listening to what Jonathan's recommending and taking time to think about your health and how to focus on it and where to find the time for that and time block it, then all the fancy business model technology stuff isn't going to matter. So it's a really important lesson, Jonathan. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing with it and talking about it for my listeners. The last question I'd like to ask my guests is a hot dog a sandwich and why?
Oh boy, I say no. Shape and the lack of coverage of the frank. Like my sandwich should have bread over top or some substrate over top of it. I don't want to see it. An open-faced sandwich is not a sandwich. And I think a hot dog is an open-faced item and doesn't count.
So open-faced sandwich is a misnomer then, in your opinion?
Correct. Jumbo shrimp, oxymoron.
All right. That is a first for the show. Well, Jonathan, if anyone wanted to follow up with you or see more about, you know, your business or your thought leadership, what's the best place for them to find you?
Sure. LinkedIn, my last name is very easy to find. It's the only one. We partner with a clinic called Revitalist, RevitalistRevitalist.com. That's where you can find us on the mental health space. And our CBD product is greencaremedical.com. It's the best in the business.
All right, great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Matthew. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks again to 650 and Gavel for sponsoring this show. The best way for others to discover this show is for you to share it with someone you think would find a value from it. Follow me on LinkedIn, since that's where I'm most active on social media, and click the bell towards the top right of my profile to get notified about all of my posts about this podcast and everything else I think is valuable for you to see. To get in touch, message me on LinkedIn or email kurbis@lawsubscribed.com. All links are in the show notes. Until next time, this is Matthew Kurbis with Law Subscribed.